Michelle.
Hi, I'm Caitlin.
Welcome to Better Words. Hey.
Hey. What's up, girl?
Well, okay. It is very, very hot at the moment.
Yeah, maybe that's why I'm feeling a little bit crazy and why I just said that.
Oh, it's so disgustingly hot here at the moment.
It is gross. 38 degrees today, and it is going to be for the rest of the week.
Ugh.
It's too hot.
Yuck. And I was painting a room today, like not fun painting, like painting a wall.
Like white. Boring. White.
Yeah. It was so hard. Oh, so hot and gross. Anyway, what have you been up to?
Well, I've actually finally finished watching Derry Girls.
Yes.
It is, oh my God, so good.
Isn't it amazing?
Oh my God, it's so funny. I think I'd watched one episode like over Christmas.
When I like pestered you too?
Maybe, yeah.
But I know you watch enough for you to know that it was my show. Like,
yeah, you were definitely.
Like, yes, Michelle, you'd love this.
Yes, yeah, it is totally up your alley. But yeah, I watched it with my roommate and we were just like, all the 90s music and everything is so good. I think my favorite bit is when they're like, it's like an assembly and the annoying like girl that they don't like is singing. She's like, I feel it in my fingers.
How good are the nuns though? Like, that sassy nun is the best.
Oh my God, she's the best. Oh. But I know. And she's like, didn't I ban this song? Like, oh my God. It's so good.
Or
and
in the first episode when they're like, you're going to be like a little flower growing. And the nun comes up and like, yes, well, that was just words. That's all it was.
Yeah. So funny. Or she's like, do you actually want me to say dramatic pause? Like... Oh, I love it. I loved it. It was
I'm so glad.
So funny.
Okay, good. I'm so glad.
Yes, yeah, so that's my most recent binge.
I'm watching it for like the third time now.
Oh, are
so
you?
It's my like fun. I was like, I'm feeling a bit shit. I need to watch something funny. Like that was my funny thing.
I know. I finished it and immediately was like, Derry Girls season 2.
The trailer just came out. It looks really good.
I haven't watched it yet. Oh, I must watch it.
It looks so good. I'm rewatching Brooklyn Nine-Nine. After our failed trivia.
Oh my God, that was not our fault.
No, it was very difficult.
It was like one of the most ridiculous trivia nights I've been to.
So when I think trivia, I think like you're going to ask me questions, A, that I'll know the answer to, but they're going to be actual like, you know, in this episode, what was this? Or like who won the first Halloween heist or something like that.
Yeah. See, there was no questions about the Halloween.
I know.
Album.
I mean, they could have done like
a whole
round. There
were questions.
It's
like, how many brothers does Amy have?
Which was good. Like that. Like that. But I thought that that's what the whole thing was going to be. No, it wasn't. So one round was like, so they have the joke that's title of your sex tape. And from pictures, you had to say what the thing
line
was.
The line was that prompted the joke.
Yeah. So
I think the only one we got right was cold air coming out of the box or something, because it was literally a box with like ice in it.
Yeah, it was really hard. And then
it was way too difficult.
I mean, the one with guessing Captain Holt's facial expressions was quite funny.
That was a pretty funny round.
Yeah.
But it went too far from there. It got too hard.
Yeah, because then the last round was guessing the name of the criminal based on...
like pictures again.
Pictures, like, but it wasn't necessarily like
to spell out their name.
Yeah, like the cold air coming out of the box one was like that was obvious, but there was one where it was like you should get the name of the criminal based on this picture of what he was trying to do to Holt, which had nothing to do with his name. Like that was really difficult.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it's a sitcom. Who cares about the villains?
Yeah, like it's not like Criminal Minds. No one remembers who the criminals are. That's not why we're watching it. We're watching it because it's comedy, not because it's crime.
Exactly.
Basically, yeah. So that was difficult. I left early because I had to work the next day and it was like in like another town near us and I just was over it. So I was really tired.
I left pretty soon after the as well.
Yeah. Which was a shame because we were all... But we did have a fun night with everyone. It was a very big team of people that we had. Not that that helped us at all.
No, I don't think it did.
I think like half of us were playing and half of us were talking. So, yeah. It was fun. It was fun. I don't think Amy Santiago would have approved. But
she would not have approved. Definitely not.
Let's draw a line under that and
it's
move
like
on.
Gina Linetti came up with the trivia.
Yeah, it was. It was very, like, bizarre.
Yeah.
Random. Yeah. It was weird. Anyway, two things I've watched in the past week, like, totally binged. The Cry and Dirty John. So both of these are, like, crime dramas. The Cry is... based in a small Australian town where a baby goes missing from a car, and it's told in a very interesting format because you know that the mum is on trial for something, but you don't like know what until the end of episode 3, and everything sort of unravels. Ooh. And yeah, it's very interesting. Asha Keddie is in it.
I love Asha Keddie.
Yeah, it's really, really good. Actually, I think you
that
and Mon
like
might
makes
enjoy
me
it.
Wanna watch
I
it.
Think you and Mon might enjoy it because, like, again, it's not like super, super like crimey. It's more like relationships, people, like
drama.
Yeah, drama. Yeah. It's very good drama. And the only thing I found difficult, I mean, I got used to it by the end, but the woman who is like the main character, she's also Queen Victoria, so I just had a hard time like seeing her in normal clothes because
oh,
she
so
plays
funny.
Queen Victoria, and I'm just like, but you're so
I
like,
know one
yeah.
thing I've seen online about Dirty John is that everyone remembers Eric Bana from The Time Traveler's Wife.
Oh.
And so they're like, I expect him to like disappear. And like,
yes.
Yeah.
So funny you should
that
mention that though, because that's the other thing that I binged and I just finished watching it today. Actually, I was just telling you before we started that if you've listened to the podcast, it's very similar. And I really appreciate how they use the narrative that, Chris Gofford had already set up in the podcast, because he wrote that in a really great way, I thought, the podcast and the series of articles on the LA Times. I just thought the way he told the story with the different timelines was really interesting. So it was cool that they based the story, like the drama, off that and not off the story itself. Like, yeah. I just think as a journalist, I'm like, oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Someone would base it off your articles. Yeah, really good. Eric Bana was really creepy as John Meehan.
I love Eric Bana.
He was so good.
He's great.
Totally forgot he was Aussie. Like, he did a really good American accent.
Oh, good.
Connie Britton was great. I had a lot of furious texts with one of my friends about the whole like rich bitch thing in this. Like, they really are. Like, it's set in Orange County, and they're really like, at one point she comes home and he's like, why did you withdraw $30,000 from the bank account? And I was like, well, lucky you had $30,000 to withdraw, wasn't it? Like, it's sort of hard because
so unrelatable.
Well, yeah, but it does, I think a lot of people find it relatable in terms of like his abusive behavior. But the thing it highlights is, yes, he was scamming her because of her wealth, but her wealth also enabled her to get out of it. In a way that a lot of people aren't privileged to be able to do, like the fact that
yes.
she could
yeah,
have $30,000 yeah. in cash out of her $400,000 bank account, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting because the way it ends is her calling the journalist back. And
oh, that's so
yeah,
cool.
It's very cool. And I imagine it's based on a real recording that he has. And basically she says, you know, I think I want to tell this story. It won't necessarily make me look good. And to be honest, it doesn't. I think that she looks like someone who is trying to believe because they want to be happy. And I think that many
universal.
Of us...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think many people can relate to that. I think the things that don't make people look good in this are the privilege that they have. But, you know, that's...
Yeah.
I mean, that's unavoidable. It is based in Orange County. And he was looking for women who had money.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, that's sort of unavoidable.
That's part of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. But it just made for lots of interesting discussions. Like The Cry, I think you'll enjoy it because it is about people and relationships more than it's not like a murdery show. In fact, there's no real there's not a lot of violence until like the last couple of episodes when everything starts to unravel. I think if anyone hasn't listened to this, but they did read the Dan Mallory, AJ Finn article in New York Times, you're probably going to be intrigued by this because it's very similar, like, behavior where people are building a life that is total bullshit. I must say, I kind of admire the way these people can do that because I cannot lie.
And just lie to themselves.
Yeah, I cannot lie. I cannot pull that shit off. So, no, like, I can't understand how they can keep track of all their lies. And he was scamming, like, multiple women. Like, I just don't know how you do that.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing to say, but that's kind of, yeah, impressive. Like, it's terrible, but. Like, yeah, props to you that you can you can keep track of that. I mean, I can't keep track of any of that shit.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you been watching anything?
Well, I have been watching New Girl. I got it on a hard drive. So I've been watching New Girl, which is just, like, it's perhaps even, like, some of the silly, like, one of the sillier sitcoms I've watched, and I'm not normally a fan of the like, oh, poor, like, female main character thing, you know, like, Zooey Deschanel's character is sort of like the clumsy, oh, I'm living with three boys, like, oh,
silly,
you know,
me.
Yeah, like, it is a bit like that, but it's just, it's so silly that I'm like, it knows what it is.
That's how I felt and about Don't Trust the Bitch in Apartment 23.
Yes, it's kind of like that. Yeah, yeah.
Like, I was like, this is ridiculous, but I'm going to go with it.
Yeah, like it. Yeah. And yeah, so I've been going with it and I think it's really funny. But yeah, the other thing I have been completely obsessed with is Ariana Grande's new album, Thank You Next. So, so good. Oh my God. I just, like,
I haven't listened to the full thing yet. I need to listen to
that's
it.
That's right. You do. And if you're going to be one of those people that's like, oh my God, Caitlin, I hate Ariana Grande, I'm like, that's fine. You do you. I love her. I love the album. And, you know, all those records she's been breaking with, like, so many streams and everything, I'm probably responsible for a fair few of them. So
I just, like, I really like her music. I was just really surprised when the articles came out the other day
About the black fishing
thing. So yeah. I was one of those people who was like, what? She's white? What? Like, I had no idea.
Yeah,
so
we actually very, had a pretty interesting discussion. Yeah, we had a conversation about that.
Yeah.
Because I've been following her for a few more years. I was like, no, I know she's white. She's Italian. Like,
so weird though. Yeah. Like, it just, I don't know. I don't think we're in any position to discuss this on the podcast because we are privileged white girls.
Yes.
But yeah, I was surprised by that. Perhaps we should link to the articles in the show notes,
yes,
just so that
definitely.
If you're not aware of it, like, have a look. But I do think she can make music.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yes, like, not, you know, not that this makes up for anything else that she may have or may ever do wrong, but don't even try and tell me she can't sing. Like, holy crap.
Yeah. 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 But yeah, I don't think we're in a position to, like, discuss that because we don't even know about it, but other people who are, I guess, better placed to discuss it have written some interesting articles that we should link to.
Yes.
So, yeah, without further ado, our interview.
Forgetting one of the most important things we have to discuss in this intro.
What's that?
We have a Facebook group
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Please come join us.
Yeah.
Because it's a bit quiet there at the moment,
well,
and we'd love to have you join
us.
We
haven't actually announced it on the podcast yet. So we made the Facebook group after our discussion with Carly about how much we love Facebook groups. So we just decided. Michelle basically added me as an admin and was like, we have a Facebook group now. And I was like, cool.
I asked you first. And then I just did it.
Yeah. But, so we have a Facebook group, Better Words Podcast Community. Search it in groups.
Please come find us. Come chat.
Request to join and we'll let you in.
Yep. We want to chat about books and podcasts and all this sort of crazy stuff that we talk about on here. And we'll also be talking about our latest episodes as well and some issues that get raised in them.
Please come join us. It's going to be fun, I promise.
Yeah, we just need a couple more people just to lighten everything up, but we have some amazing people in there already, so come join us. We'd love it.
Yeah. See you there.
Now can we,
Go to the interview.
Bye.
Our guest this week has a wealth of experience in the book industry as both a writer and publisher. She has edited an anthology of spooky Australian stories, written flash fiction, and last year celebrated the publication of her debut novel, A Superior Spectre. She has also been part of Australia's literary criticism scene, writing as a literary columnist and reviewing for some of the country's premier media organisations. Welcome to Better Words, Angela Meyer.
Thank you for having me.
It is absolutely our pleasure.
Yes, it is.
So I don't even know how to begin describing A Superior Spectre, because it's like, I would rather clunkily say it's a strange mix of sci-fi and historical fiction. It's certainly unlike any other book I've read.
Yes, I agree.
That's good.
Yeah. In a great way. How would you describe it? How do you tell people about this? What's your elevator pitch for this?
If I'm just talking to a sort of stranger, I will say, you know, that it's literary speculative fiction, sort of the same genre as, you know, Margaret Atwood, that sort of thing. And I usually tell them the basic plot, which is a man runs away from his life with an experimental technology that allows him to enter the mind of someone in the past, and that it's set in Scotland.
Well, yeah, that sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, once you say it, you're like, yeah, well, that is the story, isn't it? Why do I find that so difficult to summarise?
I think we have found it a little bit difficult to summarise in that way, because it is so unlike anything we've ever read. Like, I've never, I mean, yeah, the mix of like sci-fi or even like dystopia with the historical fiction element is not something that I've seen combined.
I struggle to say that it's straight like speculative fiction, only because we go so much into Lenora's life back in the 1700s.
The 19th century,
that you're like, oh, this feels so much like historical fiction. It's just, it's such an interesting blend. I'm really curious about the inspiration behind that. And
how did you come up with this idea?
I think it was a matter of having various elements of it floating around in my head, and then it all coalesced. So I had this sort of idea of this man who had a robot or an android helper, so that was sort of floating around, and I've always been interested in neurotechnology and neuroscience in general, so that was there. And then I've spent a lot of time in Scotland. I'm like in love with Scotland, and I was in Scotland and I was thinking about this woman who lived in the 19th century and was sort of coming of age, and was researching a bit where I was staying, which was around Cardew, and I end up having her live around where I was. And I was at the Edinburgh Book Festival, and it kind of just all came together in my mind. It was one of those amazing periods in my life where I managed to have some time and space, which is not something that I have very often. I saved really hard, and my partner at the time and I were traveling in Scotland. We were working as we were going, so that meant that we could kind of like travel for a little bit longer. And yeah, I think it was just having that kind of my mind open to the idea that I wanted to write a novel, and all of these ideas just came together. And I thought, I actually had another manuscript at the time, which I started sending out, and I withdrew that because I realized if I could pull this off, this very strange idea, that maybe it would be a much better and more ambitious novel. So I did. I gave it a go.
Which is quite scary though.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, it is a huge thing that, like you said, you had to pull it off.
Yeah, it was a challenge.
That's really scary as a writer. How did you, like, lean into that?
I think because it was so exciting and so fun, and I do like a challenge. I think I do get bored. So, and I really like the idea, too, that Australian fiction can, you know, be a very broad church and have, I mean, we've definitely seen in recent years a lot of wonderful different genres kind of coming out of Australia. And I think mainly I just I knew that the idea would be good if I managed to pull it off, and it was fun to write.
So then, you know, faced with the challenge of it and everything, you decided to, I don't want to say like scrap your safer choice, but you really, I suppose, were, what's the word I'm looking for? Ambitious maybe?
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
going for the real.
It was a creative ambition. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, I did. I did decide to scrap the other one essentially, which was a manuscript I worked on for my doctorate. But the world that Jeff comes out of is actually the world that I built in that novel. So it's not kind of wasted. It ends up just being sort of background work. And it's just like a less sophisticated novel in some ways, like in terms of the amount of ideas that I'm putting into it. I guess this book carries more layers to it. To try and do that and still make it like readable and make it entertaining and make it make the characters empathetic, that people would want to keep reading. They were all layers of the challenge, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think you succeeded there because, I mean, we both really love the characters. I think especially Lenora, like she's so interesting, and her story feels so like feminist, and there's a lot of reflection on, you know, her role and the, I guess, her gender and the power of sexuality and everything. So why did you want to explore that?
So I've always been interested in the idea of desire, and I guess that comes out a lot in my writing, and a lot of my favorite books, I guess, have sort of desire as a theme, and desires often repressed or held back or expressed in, you know, not the right way for the time or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I think in writing a woman character in the 19th century, I mean, naturally, especially when she's sort of forced out of where she's quite comfortable into a different environment, which is more sort of repressive and buttoned down.
Yes.
I was really interested in her being almost like her story being instead of her sort of searching for something, it's that she actually was quite happy and then she's forced out of that. And then to take things further, you know, she begins to become aware of this invasion of her senses, which is Jeff from the future, not that she knows that, and then she has to sort of find out what is happening to her, you know, because she really fears that she's going mad. And I think with her and with, there was a significance in making obviously Jeff a man and making her a woman, and that he feels a lot of shame over his like aberrant desires, which I won't go into, but he doesn't think a lot about the consequences of the way that he treats the women in his life and the way that his continual visits to Leonora might be affecting her. So there is a bit of an idea there that, you know, he's very self-aware and forward-thinking, he thinks, but he's still misogynistic, you know. He's still much more concerned with his own selfish needs, even if that is, you know, to die. He wants to die.
Yes, because he also leaves his wife.
I
think family. You see that transcend just Lenora's story. It's throughout the whole novel.
Yeah. And then the woman, the landlord, who sort of takes him in, and he's very dismissive of her. I tried to sort of make the language around that very casual, but, you know, it's something that I think as women we become quite used to, you know. It's
I agree, and that is something that I think what you just said then about he, you know, thinks he is quite self-aware.
Yeah.
That line is just really sticking with me about, familiar, you know, various men in the world, because I think that is, you know, especially in this day and age that we're in right now, you know, we'd all love to believe that we're so far beyond all of these things, but I think we've got a little way to go. But that's a whole other discussion.
People who say, oh, well, I don't see gender, or I don't see your race, and it's like, you're not really acknowledging the problem there.
Yeah.
But I mean, one reason I wanted to make Jeff sympathetic in himself is that it is a systematic thing, you know. It's sort of, he is a product of his society, as much as you also say, you know, mate, kind of do better, you know.
Yeah. No, he is really as well.
Yeah. I think there was a line that stuck with me in the book, and I'm probably absolutely going to butcher it saying it back to you, but there's this wonderful quote from Lenora who says, perhaps women's madness is just glimpses of the future or something that. And I ended up writing that down in my reading journal because it just stuck me so much that I really enjoyed the exploration, especially towards the end of her hysteria, where we know that something is very, very wrong. Yes. But obviously it's totally beyond any sort of comprehension of anyone at that time. And that just, it feels so meta. And I loved that. Like, it really challenged me as a reader, which in an enjoyable way though.
Thank you.
So I really, really loved that though, the discussion around women's hysteria generally at that time, being something that, you know, there were women who were taken away and women who were cast out away from society because of their hysteria.
Yeah.
And now we look back, I guess, with kinder eyes to say, well, why was that?
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting though, that this suggestion, obviously an imagined suggestion that this is what's happening in her life. But I mean, it could also be, it's just, I think
give us time, it might be true.
Yeah, this book just gives us so many options, because you can kind of even ask yourself, like, you know, is she even, and I'm going off on a tangent, but is she even really experiencing this, or is this her own psychosis? Like, it's just very,
that's right.
It spiraled in my mind as I was reading it, and I found it really engaging.
Thank you.
And I'm glad that Caitlin's reading this one too, because it's not something Caitlin would usually pick up, but I'm glad we get to read it together because we can discuss it.
Because
it's so many different elements of this, and it does feel very complex and layered, and I can see why it was not the safe option.
And thank
so, congratulations.
Thank you so much for saying that. I mean, I'm still kind of astounded that I managed to write a book with a plot. Because it's actually one of the hardest things to do. I mean, for some writers, not all writers, because I work with writers in my day job, it's easier for some than others. But
no, I agree though.
Yeah,
I agree, because I mean, someone like, for example, a Jeffrey Archer.
Yeah,
he is such a master storyteller, not necessarily a brilliant wordsmith, and that's fine, because you kind of go into his books expecting a rollicking good tale.
Yes.
And then sometimes I'm put off by a book that I see is on the man booker list, because I'm like, well, I'm not going to understand that. That's going to be
just
way
be
too
sprawling words. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And like, there is a time and a place for words, and for me, like, the best authors get both the words and the plot,
the balance.
Yeah,
yeah. My favorite books do that too.
Yeah, I feel like one of the best examples of this, who's also very successful commercially, is Victoria Schwab. I think she's a brilliant example.
Yeah,
okay, I haven't either.
Well, see, I'm really bad because I like bang on about her being one of my favorite authors, and I haven't read her Shades of London series, which is the one that has catapulted her into, like, I guess, fame. I read her I think it was her second novel, actually. The Archived, and then the sequel to that, The Unbound, and then her other novel, Vicious. And I feel like she does that very, very well, but I need to read the rest of her books in saying that. But you definitely managed to blend those two things. Was that difficult as a writer, and as, I guess, as someone who's in publishing too, so you have that other perspective of knowing what works commercially and what will sell? Was that difficult?
Yeah, no, you have to not think about that stuff when you're writing, that's for sure. Like, the whole marketing side of things, that just has to go out of your head. But I think when I think about plot, I think maybe a little bit what I enjoy and what I think is something I've learnt more about in the last, like, 5 years or so, including, like, writing this book but also working on other people's book, is more conflict and tension. So a book might not have, like, a beginning, middle, end, like, really you know, clear plot, but it will still have this tension in the writing. I'm thinking about Deborah Levy's most recent book that I, of course, the name has gone out of my head, but it's nonfiction, and it's just, I mean, it's hard to describe because it's sort of her going through a particular part of her life, and it's thoughts and it's things that happen and things like that. But it's like a page turner because she holds this tension between ideas in the book, and it is set over a period of time. So there is a sort of movement in it, but it's these kinds of things I think I'm really interested in. Yeah. Like those sorts of aspects of books. And when I work with writers, obviously, I'm trying to find ways to articulate these things to them when we're working together. But when you're working on your own work, it has to become sort of like a natural function or something, you know, because you kind of just have to go into the writing and then the editing of your own work, and there has to be a level of trust and that you just know how to do it. And that just takes years, like for me, many years of practice and many years of reading and many years of deep reading. And I think you could probably lose it at various points in your life as well, you know, if something gets in the way of it. But I think it's like, I don't know, learning an instrument or something.
It's so hard with writing too, because there's no specific measurable outcome. Like you can learn an instrument and you can
play the song well.
Yeah, you can play the song well, or you can do exams and that's it. But then when you look at writing, you know, even if we use publication as a marker for success,
there are still good books that don't get published because of the market, and that's when we come to that.
And, you know, there's some crap that gets published too.
Absolutely.
You know, that sells amazingly. And I think we all know what I'm talking about. Absolutely. So, you know, is that then the mark of like, it's just such an arbitrary marker of success. And I think that's something that every writer really struggles with. And it's interesting that you have the perspective of both sides then.
Yeah, I think in some ways working publishing is good because you're really aware of the realities, how tough it is. Like it really is tough. The industry is really tough. But at the same time, it feels like a real milestone to have the first novel out there. Like it does. Yeah, there is something very tangible about, you know, when it comes in the mail and it's got a cover on it, and then the next step when people are reading it, like talking to you, and still, you know, to have these responses where people are spending time in the heads of these characters that I've made up in my own mind is very surreal and lovely. And like, and I don't know, I would love to, I think the main thing for me with the whole publishing and market and blah, 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 is that I just want to be able to keep writing novels. So, yes, you know, you want to have a level of success that just allows you to do that. And whether that means, you know, you also just have a day job that supports you enough so you can keep writing, and, you know, hopefully lovely small presses will always come on board. But you don't know. It's really tricky. There's a lot of people who have their first novel published too and never get a second novel published, because the first one didn't sell enough, and there's this sort of tyranny of sales figures in the industry. It's full on.
And I just want to do some myth busting as well. You work in publishing, but did you still have to go through the pitching process that any debut author would face?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, where I'm lucky is that I definitely did. Had met lots of people, so I got an agent, Martin Shaw, but I did get rejected by a US agent before that. I'll tell you that. When Martin sent it around, I think where I was definitely privileged was that people knew my name, so that it would get read fairly quickly, which doesn't happen for everyone. But still, it took a year before I had a publishing contract and a lot of rejections. They were very lovely, but it was definitely, you know, you've read it, it's a weird book. I think a lot of them didn't quite know how to position it.
so much of publishing, it is a business.
Perfectly understandable that they wouldn't want to publish things that they don't know. If they think it won't sell. It's the same reason why anyone, you know, like why cafes don't make disgusting cakes, you know, like because they won't sell.
Or something that even just sounds a little bit strange.
Yeah,
because if you have to say to someone, no, it tastes better than it sounds, like that's the rate of purchase is definitely going to be lower. But just before we I want to move on to you know, some discussions around anxiety and stuff like that. But before we do, there's an interesting quote that you shared on your website from Craig Hildebrand, which is, to compare Lenora's story to other historical fictions is to become complicit in Jeff's haunting. Do we read other stories to escape our own? And in reading them, do we confirm on these characters a life of conflict and tragedy and trauma that only exists because we are there, spectres in the minds of these characters? That's huge, a huge concept. What did you think of that when you read that quote?
I was so relieved when Craig, when I saw his review, because he just got this whole layer of the book that none of the reviews that I'd seen had gotten, which is the fact that it's really written by someone whose whole life is literature. So there is inherently in it this sort of question about reading and empathy. And I don't think I really knew when I started writing it that that was going to come into it, but it did. 'Cause we're, as readers, sort of forced to see things from Jeff's point of view as he's forced to see things through a woman's point of view. And it doesn't actually change him. Does it change us, you know, when we're reading Jeff's quite challenging point of view? Does it change us when we read? And even though my whole life is books, I swing between having this, like, you know, adamant belief that they are good and that they do good in the world and that they're essential, and then this skepticism that they don't change anything at all and they're just a way, another way to escape ourselves, you know. So, yeah, I guess that's sort of there in the book, and how wonderful it is to, like, have someone attentively read your book and find these things in it. So I'm so grateful for that.
I think it's such an interesting concept, because when you summed up just then saying, you know, you do have those two perspectives that often interplay, I didn't realize until you kind of said that, that that's sort of how I feel as well.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, because, I mean, we're in the same position as you, like our whole life is books, whole life, but, you know, we're both huge readers. And I'd like to think that my reading does really change me.
Yep.
But then again, I'm such a voracious reader that I'm seeking out books that will change my perspective. So I think that's a very privileged position to be in, and one that's not general.
Well, yes, that's true. But it is also interesting that as a big reader, we potentially take more out of some of these books than other people do.
Yeah.
But that also... like, I could name so many books that I think have, you know, changed the way I've thought about things or have affected my life in some big way. But you also, what was I going to say? Damn it, I completely lost what I was going to say.
That's okay.
It was something profound, I think. But anyway, maybe that means it's time to move on from that.
Yes. Okay.
That's right. If it comes back to you, you can bring it in.
Okay, so let's move on from that then to a bit more of a discussion around publishing and literary criticism in Australia particularly. So we're really interested to hear your thoughts on, you know, the state of reviews in mainstream media.
Sure. Well, since I've been working in publishing, I haven't been writing reviews just because it's sort of a conflict of interest. So I'm more of a reader of reviews now, which is quite a pleasure. It's hard because I don't know if I currently have any specific thoughts about it, other than it's sad that there aren't as many review pages as there used to be. And that's sad as a publisher, you know, the kind of space for people to become aware of new books is has shrunk. We rely a lot on the booksellers and them like hand selling and talking to people. And then there's, you know, spaces like Goodreads, like global online spaces where anybody can review a book, and people, some people write really amazing, insightful reviews, and some people are just really not writing very good
yeah.
spaces. You know,
just, it's their own personal reading diary of like, yeah, I liked this, just, I didn't like this, you know.
Yeah, just like, you know, not really making judgments about books, but actually just being like, I didn't like it. Yeah, which is not really a review.
It's not. And it doesn't mean anything to anyone else because we don't know why you didn't like it
yeah,
or why exactly. you did, you know.
Yeah.
So with things like Goodreads then, you know, obviously that's impacted on review pages in the mainstream media. But has there also been, I guess, this feeling that these gatekeepers of our interests maybe can be circumvented by social media?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's fairly true. I think there's a sort of demographic of people that would actually read book reviews. There's a demographic, and then there's also, I mean, in the newspapers and maybe something like Australian Book Review, people who read them, people who seek them out. And then there's a lot of other people who read books but just wouldn't buy a newspaper, or wouldn't, or they might see something if it's shared by someone they know online. I don't know. Like, my honest answer is that I don't know currently what the sort of role of reviews are. I really love reading a well-written review. I'll often will buy a book because I've seen a review of it that tells me what the book is, not just, you know, whether it's good or bad, but it, so actually sometimes it doesn't matter if the review says it's good or bad, but whether it tells me if it's something I'm interested in reading. And I, as a reviewer, I was always interested in doing that. Like, I would make a critical point, but I would make sure that any reader encountering the review knew enough about the book itself to know whether they might still be seeking it out. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
Not recounting the plot, but like saying, here are some of the themes and ideas, and a little bit about the plot, or
So do you think that we need some more diverse voices in those traditional spaces?
Because definitely,
yeah, they're generally, I just think of a book review in The Australian as being written by an old white man.
I don't think they all are necessarily, but I think in all areas of the industry we need more diversity, 100%. Like, it's taking longer than it should, and we all have a part to play in it. I have a part to play in it, my bosses, everybody, newspapers, magazines, and I do think things are slowly getting there, but people at the top have to be interested to change, and I think that's a challenge.
Because there's a fear then of giving up the what they see as giving up power.
Well, they just have to be in. They just have to care. I mean, that sounds really bad, but there's so much busyness, and people just kind of like getting on with things and not and getting too tired to kind of like continue investing in the industry that they're in. Does that make sense?
But it's just easier to stick with the status quo.
That's the sort of thing I'm saying, and there needs to be more thought, but it's a sort of capitalist issue in some ways. It's like that there's a system and it gets reinforced and reinforced, and to make cracks in it is hard when you're just working from the bottom, but from things to happen at the top, people have to, they have to care enough to do it. And I think, like, I'm being super skeptical again, but I think there's a lot of blasé-ness.
I mean,
which is horrible.
To draw a similar point, we went and saw On the Basis of Sex when it came out, and that was like a prime example of it didn't really affect
those in charge, so they just kind of, oh, but we'll just go with it because this is the way it's always been. And you know,
there's like, a lot of this is the way it's always been in the publishing industry, I can tell you.
And in a lot of things, where we need to change, whether it's you know, in so many different workplaces,
absolutely,
so many different things. And I think that's something I've been thinking about this weekend as well, because I just finished Say Hello by Carly Findlay, and that was talking a lot about disability and that diversity. And I think it's so obvious that we just need to change, but
absolutely,
it's so ingrained in the way that we're brought up that it can be really difficult.
Yeah, and if you're the one bringing that stuff up at a company and constantly bringing it up, you sometimes, I mean, you have to keep doing it and you have to keep fighting, but you take on that labor. And then if you're not being supported by your bosses, by your peers, it can also mean that you are in a difficult position, you know, like
that's something Carly puts beautifully in the book as well. Anyway, that was it. Sorry for that little diversion, but we're having so much fun chatting to you.
No, it's great to chat to you too. Thank you.
Well, the other thing that we wanted to talk to you about was you wrote a really fascinating piece for the Wheeler Center in 2013 on, you know, writing and anxiety and, you know, all of that. Oh, I suppose writing and anxiety.
Inadequacy.
Yes. Oh, just all of it. So now, you know, that we're in 2019, you know, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about that now, I suppose?
Yeah, look, I can't remember the details of the piece, but
it was a while ago. Sorry, I was deep stalking you when I pulled
That's fine. But anxiety is something that I still live with and have to deal with on an almost daily basis. And it's another one of those things, I think, when you're in a kind of professional capacity, it's very difficult to bring up how these things affect you in work sense, because really the idea is that you're just getting on with things and getting on with your job and doing your job that you're getting paid to do.
Just do the work.
But I think one of the hardest things about my day job is in the anxiety factor, is that I take on the responsibility for other authors and other and people. They're all people I care about very much, not just my own work. And I think that's something I didn't entirely anticipate how affecting that would be, you know, because then you're going through their ups and downs and things like that, while at the same time you have a company mission and you have, you know, you have your job to do. So that's something that's like a new aspect compared to in 2013. On the writer's side of things, I think it's a little bit calmer actually. And I think having the novel out has helped with that. It was a sort of marker that sort of helped to go, okay, I've done that. I'm terrified now that, you know, I may not be able to write something as interesting maybe again.
Second book syndrome.
Yeah, but at least I have the thing where I have released a kind of a novel within different genres, so I can kind of go anywhere from there. I'm not really stuck like a crime writer would be or something like that, where, you know, if people like the first one, they want more of that.
I have no idea what to expect from your future work. I really don't.
That's good. That's good. So that's a plus, and that's like something nice for me and not as anxious, I guess.
Yeah. But I guess the hard thing with your first book is that it's so beautifully written that, you know, that in itself is something to cause anxiety. And
hopefully.
Put that on you. I just know how I feel when, you know, if you get, you're in a subject at university and you get one good mark on an assignment and you're like, oh, I got to keep up that standard now. Like, shit, of course. Straight out of the gate, I've got a HD. Now no, I need to keep that up.
You do. Yeah, that's definitely something I have always done, which is set the bar higher and higher for myself. And at work too, I've had a very big successful book. So there's also the fact that I have published other books that have done well, but you know, when you've had like a big one, there's also that not wanting people to see you as a one-hit wonder or something. So yeah. There's always some anxiety, you know, no matter what I'm doing. I think that is a part of my personality, but on the flip side of it, it has meant, I don't know, I think there's a level of care there. And I know that one thing that I don't doubt is I always do my best because I think everything through as much as I can in the time I have. And I think that's a side to it that I can be grateful for my anxiety.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think there are so many anxiety superpowers and amazing empathy and really good emotional intelligence is one of the two of them, I think, that I've found anyway. They're my like my little superpowers as opposed to being giant pains in the ass.
yeah. And I mean, there has to be something good because the suffering side of it is not good. Yeah. It's really good to think about the positive side of it. And actually, I've talked, like, quite a few writers have anxiety, and it's something that you can channel on a good day.
It's a funny sort of thing to think about, you know, writing anxiety. Like, does this creative life make us anxious, or do we seek out this creative life because we're inherently prone to anxieties?
It's probably a bit of both. I think I definitely sort out the things that I do, certainly writing, because of that agitation in me, and also being fairly ambitious. I think there's sort of part of my drive is related to it, but it has that flip side where you're like, now I'm doing too many things, you know, and then you get anxious about that.
I think the thing that sort of made me feel a little bit calmer, because I was like, oh, well, everyone experiences this, was I saw Helen Garner speak in Geelong last year, and she mentioned at one point that, you know, each book she does, she, by the end of it, thinks she's worked this out and she knows how to be a writer, and then she goes to start the next piece of writing, and it doesn't actually even have to be a book. It can be any piece of writing, no matter what the length, and she goes to start and she's like, how do I do this again? Like, what? I'm wretched. I can't do this. I'm never going to produce anything good ever again. And I was like, well, if Helen Garner, who, for people who aren't familiar, is, you know, one of the literary legends of Australia, if she can feel that way and have so many critically acclaimed books, we're just going to have to go with it, because it's just
hope for the everything. Rest of us.
Yeah, like, but it's not hopeful because you're like, oh, crap, we all have to do it. But at the same point, it's like, it's just something you have to accept that we're all going to go through. It's no matter what you're writing. Like, I'm not writing fiction, and I still, every time I write a story at work, even if I'm writing 4 stories in a day, there's still that blank page anxiety. We're like, what's my story? What am I going to do?
Yeah. And
it's still like you can churn out some great articles and then turn around the next day and be like, I'm just having a really off day where everything I write sounds like crap, but I'm at a daily newspaper, so it's just
so you just have to get on with it.
And totally today's understand. Just going to be below my average, so it's an interesting conundrum, and I'm sure many creative people can relate, even if, you know, like, I think it's the same for bloggers, for Instagrammers, anyone who's doing something that doesn't have a tangible success marker, whether it's photography or anything, like, it's sort of this creative dilemma.
I think you'd actually get a bit worried if it became too easy. I think actually you might do
like when you
wrong.
Like, did you ever have that moment when you're at school and you like walk out of a test and you're like, oh, that was really good, and you're like, shit, I probably just got everything wrong.
That
was way too easy. Oh, I can't have prepared that well.
Yeah, I had that once. I was the first person to leave a math exam, and I was like, I'm probably gonna fail, because that was just I don't remember, but I remember I think I was feeling a little bit sick, but I had finished and I put my hand up and the teacher was like, Caitlin, are you sure you want to leave? And I was like,
Yeah, I'm sure. And I was feeling a little bit sick, so I think that probably contributed. But I really was the first person to leave. I may have skipped one question. I don't remember. But I
you
was
know
the,
what?
But, yeah.
I think, you know, authors who are really confident about their work, my theory is that their editor probably does a lot.
Yeah, that's true. Or, you know, they end up being like Dan Mallory and just
being
an absolute, like, I don't even know where to begin. But, I mean, that confidence is a whole issue in itself.
Yes, very unique case, I think.
Yes. Hopefully so.
Hopefully, yes.
Yeah. One, hopefully that is an anomaly.
Yes.
But, oh, my God, it's a good story.
Oh, it was.
I mean, truth really is stranger than fiction.
I know. I couldn't believe it. I was just like,
oh, my God.
Actually, yeah, what was the reaction of, like, you know, people in your office and stuff and people in publishing? Because
mostly fascination, a bit of definitely horror, you know, especially when that line about his publishing salary, we were like, what? And also then, you know, basically because he had people doing all the work because he was out of the office pretending to have cancer. That made me angry. That made me angry because I'm sure they were women. But I must say I was also just vaguely amused by it because I was like,
it's almost too ridiculous that you're like, how did he get away with it? How did he keep track? How did anyone believe it?
Yeah, but you know, like we all believe it.
Just got to carry yourself with the confidence of a mediocre white man.
Like, yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
You can get anywhere and do anything. So to finish, I think it'd be really interesting if we all sort of shared whether we would use the technology that Jeff uses in A Superior Spectre if that indeed became available to us.
It is an interesting question. You know, I think the way that I've set it up is that it's at an experimental stage, but the idea is that it would be marketed and become normal. And to me, I think it would be like, it would be normalized. It would be the way that we think about buying, you know, the newest iPhone or whatever, if it was widely available on the market. So I think in the context of that future time, I probably would.
Yeah, I've got to say I agree. I think I definitely want to know medically that everything's okay and I wouldn't be trying it in the experimental phase. And, you know, if it says only go back 3 times, I certainly wouldn't be pushing that boundary.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, is that I 100% would, but I'd follow the rules.
Yes, I would follow
To think I would follow the rules anyway. I mean,
it'd be scary though. Like, it would be so scary because what if you like got sent back and you were in a battle or something? Like, that would be shit.
Well, then you wouldn't want to go back probably.
And also I just want to know, and Angela, it's your world, so you can you know, make it up, but could you choose different time frames, or is it just the luck of the draw? Is the gamble of it part of the excitement?
I think in this first phase of the chips, it's the gamble of it that is part of the excitement of it. It's like someone, you know, I imagine it's beyond a time of it's partly a leisure drug and it's partly a leisure tech. So so it's people, you know, really bored, I guess, and sort of overworked and just like want to completely escape imagine how large the population is by then and, you know, how stressed we are about the environment and all those things, and they just want to take a trip to another time frame,
to a simpler time,
lose but themselves, like, you know, as in lose their, themselves is gone, they are someone else.
I think it has such, it could create a more empathetic society though if people actually learned.
Yes,
but will they?
Will abuse
the
it. That's the science fiction.
Well,
thing.
Exactly. In an ideal world.
Yeah.
But do humans ever learn from their past mistakes?
No.
Look at the world.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, like if we had another hour chatting, I'm sure we could fix everything.
Oh, definitely. Better pour a glass of wine and
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
It's been such a pleasure. Angela, where can people find you online?
Literaryminded.com.au. And I'm basically literary minded everywhere, which was my MySpace name back in the day and became my handle on everything. So
I love that you kept it.
Stuck with
well,
it.
At least you had a good one. Like, it wasn't like baby love. X underscore.
69.
My old Hotmail.
That was not mine. I just made that off the top of my head. That was absolutely not mine.
Sure.
My old Hotmail email address, like, and I think... No, I think it was a Hotmail. I was going to say it might have been Emerson or something, but yeah. I think it was Hotmail.
Emerson.
Was KitKat.chocolate.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, well, since we're sharing, mine was like Bumblebee something. I don't know where that came from.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for joining us,
no
Angela.
Worries. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us and have a lovely evening.
Thank you.
Bye.
You too.
Bye.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Better Words. If you enjoyed it, we'd love it if you left a rating or review on iTunes. It really would mean the world to us.
And you can also find us at our website, betterwordspodcast.com, and on social media at BetterWordsPod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Bye!
Bye!